And we will start up. And again, welcome everybody. Everybody's here with, actually in the room have Renata and Dave and Katya and Laura and Don, and on the phone have Paul Butler and Chanel calling in from the council. Gil Helder had emailed me. He was thought he might be able to make it, but apparently not. So we'll go ahead and get started. Just a few announcements at the beginning. So I haven't seen you all for a little bit. I missed the last meeting. But did listen to it. Just so everybody knows, we redesigned the website. If you all have tried to go there, you might have, until a week or so ago, kind of had difficulty finding stuff just because it was getting a little overloaded. It was in a design that...
If I told you it was my homepage, would you believe me?
I would not. In fact, I would not. But, you know. So anyway, all the documents that go out to you do go up there. Now, some of them, there's some lag time. But, you know, if you need something, you want to check on it, it should be there. And, yeah, it might be useful for other people, too, if, you know, send them that site. Again, hopefully it's more navigable now. The next few meetings, because this one was pushed back a little bit to the middle of the month, just to make sure everybody knows, we'll be back, as far as I know, on schedule for next meeting's on June 7th, and then July 5th, and then August 2nd. Now, I don't recall, at least offhand, if anybody had any conflicts with those dates. But if you do, you know, if we're losing critical mass, we can try to reschedule. But right now, June 7th, July 5th, August 2nd. So again, the first Wednesday of each month, back to the regular schedule. So 2 to 4 o'clock, first Wednesday of every month. You know, we'll try to maybe improve our technology a bit so we don't have to, like, piece together multiple phones. But if you do need to call in, just let me know. I know it's summer vacation season ahead, so, you know.
August 2nd date may be the only one that was a problem.
That is problematic. I mean, okay. And would moving ahead be better or moving it back a little bit better?
Actually, it's in a sort of two-week period that's problematic. So I think I am home free between July 5th and July 15th, which is when it becomes a little dicey.
Okay.
You want to invoke the August and then tuck it home
from the previous page. Aha. As long as that's all you're invoking.
Richard?
Yes.
This is Chanel. I'll also be out of town that week, so I won't be able to make the meeting on the 2nd as well.
Okay. Well, via email circulate a few alternative dates. Hopefully it'll work. I know it's a difficult time, right? And I'll also kind of like try to game out a bit, like when things will be coming out and deadlines to see if it's, you know, what's going to be the most useful.
July 5th.
Yeah, July 5th.
Something tells me I'm supposed to be away the 4th of July, which means...
Yeah. Good. Well, it is right after the holiday, so...
It is. So anybody who's going away the 4th of July...
That's right. I don't know.
...plans on being somewhere the 4th of July.
That's right.
Won't be back on the 5th.
That's right.
Well, this is Paul. I was going to suggest that there's a way that we cancel the August meeting just because it's August. But if July is going to be... difficult, maybe we could cancel the July meeting and meet in August.
Right, or what we might be able to do, so if folks would just check your calendars, let me know. If you know, folks have problems with July 5th, what we might do is we might push it back, have a late July meeting before we get into the trouble zone for Renata, so that you can kind of cover a combined July-August and push it back. That might end up working better timing-wise, too.
That works for me.
In the flow. All right, well, I'll follow up with an email about scheduling then. all right. Again, so right now, out for comment, there were two documents. The first draft of report number 5 and the second draft of report number 2. Those are on the agenda for today. Certainly, you know, happy to address any questions. I expect, you know, I don't know what stage people might have been reviewing those, but... happy to, you know, talk about anything preliminarily. And just want to kind of, next up, what's around the corner, kind of three big things. Two on general provisions, we're going to have some language for various enhancements, penalty enhancements, as well as some language on attempts. The thought being, before we dive into specific offenses, though property offenses even, we really need to kind of have a base on those things, right? Like, how's attempt going to work, and, to what extent generally applicable penalty enhancements are out there. So wanted to get those out, then property offenses. And we hope to have property offenses to you at some point, probably now. We'll see how much polishing now remains in the coming weeks, but some point in June. We will probably do this as one big bundle. I think, unless you tell me otherwise, with more time for review rather than piecemeal it. I think conceptually it's more helpful to kind of see how the pieces fit together.
I'm sorry, when you say the this, what is the this?
Property fences.
The property fences, yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. And that's gonna be the bulk of these summer months. We will start to again be working ahead, looking at drug offenses, but those won't be coming to you until maybe end of August or September, so ways off. So really the new things that are gonna come are gonna be enhancements, penalty enhancements, attempts, and property offenses. With that, maybe I'm gonna turn it over to Michael to kind of talk through the comments on the mistake and kind of above all intoxication sections in the comments that you gave. But I wanted to say a couple things. One, all the comments were great, very helpful, appreciate it. This is hard stuff too, in particular with respect to intoxication, right? So before Michael dives into that, it just gets, it's tricky. Few jurisdictions have fully fleshed this out. Leads to litigation, et cetera. So there's good reasons to be specific on this, but just want to be clear that this is an unusually difficult area, and how much we want to codify versus some of these issues addressed more in commentary. I think that's a live question here. I know in the past, a lot of preference for putting it in the code, but it may be that we're getting to a level of specificity and complexity that it's going to rise in so few cases, it is better suited for commentary. So I just put that out there as a general frame for how we resolve the remaining issues. Do we do it via commentary or changes to the code? And Michael's got ideas and wants to talk through the comments that we received, because we from multiple folks. But yeah, with that,
can I just say like this formatting better? I have found the previous stuff where it was down here, the number two, is that just
like the cover page.
Yes.
Great.
So many words, and it's just which report, which
we have so many words.
Too many.
I know.
And
too many words.
And the chapter identification is good. That helps me sort it. Yeah.
Great.
Oh,
well,
really?
Well, little
by report number. But
little
case,
tweaks.
Like,
what's helpful to you all. And again, I hope the website too will help to it groups them now by general documents, general provisions. Oh, and there's going to be
including the members.
Property offenses, including the members. So and they're going to be kind of in chronological order. So again, hopefully. You guys are getting a lot. I know it's hard for us, right? Even though we're in the thick of it, and for you guys having to wear many hats and jump into this, I understand it's very hard to navigate. So, tips, suggestions on how to make it easier, just let us know. And that new compilation document, we're going to try to keep updating it with here's just the statutory language. We'll pretty soon we'll start to do that with commentary too, so that we always have kind of an easy place to go and grab the latest developments.
I'm glad to know it's not just me.
who...
No, and again, I'm just, this is just a slice of what you guys do, so yeah.
I'm trying to translate that for the people that are reviewing.
Sure.
Before we move on, you said previously the next three big things. I only got two, but I think because you meant with respect to general provisions that it was divided into two things, language on penalty enhancements, and then the second thing was... attempt,
that's
and then
right.
the third thing is property.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Sure,
and, you know, different codes in other states, sometimes they put these in co-ed offenses, you know, conspiracy, attempt, in their general part. Sometimes they move it out. That's an organizational thing we can certainly talk about, but I think more to the point, we just wanted to make sure, again, to, like, get some clarity on where we're going with attempt liability before... get into property offenses and specific offenses. So conspiracy, it would be great to also have, but, you know, for property offenses, arguably, you know, that can wait a bit. Before we get to drug offenses, you know, we need to have, or at that time, we need to have a picture of conspiracy. So that's the workflow plan. All right. Yeah, Michael, take it away.
So yeah, again, all the comments were great, super helpful. There are three in particular, three like general topics that I kind of prepared to discuss. But as we discuss them, if there are things that questions or anything issues anyone wants to raise, go ahead and do it. So the first is deliberate ignorance. And there's a document up there that just helps to combine some of the proposals.
And Paul, I'll email this to you and Chanel here just in a minute, the document.
Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
It just combines some of the proposals that were in some of the agency comments, just provides a helpful point of departure for discussion. The issue of deliberate ignorance, there's a proposal from PDS and a proposal from USAO. To some extent, they're coming from different directions. I think it's probably worth, just for purpose of organization, starting with USAO's and then working towards PDS's. So the USAO's proposal is to replace the phrase "with the purpose of avoiding criminal liability" with the phrase "with the purpose of avoiding knowledge of whether the circumstance existed" in the second prong of the deliberate ignorance general provision.
Sorry, just a second, let me get this back. Yeah.
It's a broadening of, or apparent, well, yeah, I'd like to ask, get USAO's thoughts on this. It appears to broaden the scope of deliberate ignorance in that the focus is just upon whether or not purpose of avoiding knowledge of whether the circumstance existed, as opposed to having the purpose of preserving a defense for a subsequent prosecution. The rationale, or one rationale, is this would help to clarify that, or to ensure that the prior proposal wouldn't be misinterpreted as to require proof that the defendant knew that his or her actions would be against the law, and it's highlighted that what is relevant is the defendant's awareness of the circumstances, not the legality of his or her actions in that circumstance. So the question is, to get an understanding, of how this would operate. One concern might be that So in the sort of what would appear at least to be the least deliberate or the least culpable kind of deliberate ignorance would be, like, let's say the situation where a mother picks up her child from school, puts a backpack in the car, drops the daughter off at a play date, and then keeps driving with the backpack home. She smells what might be marijuana.
And she dropped the kid off at a play date?
Well. Yeah,
okay,
I know.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
It was an ice cream social.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
How old is your child?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. All right.
Michael's worried.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Pleasantville. You know, we've done so much.
SAT prep class.
Yeah. There we go. SAT prep class. We talked so much about the punch bowls and, right. and intoxication. I figured we'd sanitize things today a little bit. So anyways, right, so in that situation, the mother opts not to check the daughter's backpack because, let's just assume, she just doesn't want to know. If her daughter is, in fact, using drugs, like, it's something that she doesn't want to know. That situation seems like...
Let me use another example. I'm sorry, only because marijuana is one in D.C. that becomes...
Sure. Let's... cocaine.
PCP.
Cocaine. PCP.
I am
the serious dust comes out.
And those things just smell...
That's why I was trying to...
Okay.
That's why I was trying to focus the audience.
Fair enough.
Today, reasonable smell alone, or even in combination, does that constitute reasonable...
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be a pain.
Yeah.
I just want to think through something that actually...
Sure. Yeah, so let's say there's like a white powdery residue on the outside of the bag. Could be chalk, might not be. Inside the bag there's, some cocaine. So the point...
Now this isn't as good because powdery substance is not as distinct and clear.
I remember testimony that liquid PCP has a distinct chemical odor.
Okay.
So,
right. So let's go with PCP.
Let's go with
like formaldehyde. Gotcha.
Testimony? Okay.
Let's go with PCP. Or, you know what, let's see. Now, we might be able to make this even a little bit more realistic. So the daughter had a bad friend. Mother told her not to hang out with the bad friend anymore. The bad friend is known for drug use and having other people use drugs as well. Mother goes to pick up daughter from school, and up there she is hanging out with bad friend and, receives some sort of package from the bad friend, puts in her backpack, okay? The point here being that in that situation where the mother, the reason why she's not checking is simply because she doesn't want to know. Because that would seem to be the clearest case that the person is not as culpable as the knowing actor. Yet it would appear under this proposal that this person would count as deliberately ignorant. So I'm just curious as to what people's thoughts were on that.
She is deliberately ignorant.
But it's because she wants to avoid an awkward conversation. That's what I liked about the weed example, right? It sounded of like, oh, God, I am not talking to this unpleasant teenager. Not because she's trying to escape her own potential criminal liability. At least that's not what I heard from that hypo.
Well, I heard it the same. And in both hypos, as I heard it, the mom simply doesn't want to face the possibility of drug abuse by the child.
Right.
So in either case, she's simply avoiding knowledge of the circumstance. It has nothing to do with whether it's criminal for the child or her or anything else. And that's that's what we're getting. It's simply objective.
Right, no, but so the question is, right, so the sort of the justification for willful ignorance doctrine, which is the one like that the U.S. Supreme Court has cited to, is that in certain situations, absence of knowledge can be as culpable as possessing knowledge. And so the goal of constructing a willful blindness doctrine is trying to figure out what set of circumstances best characterizes this equivalency in substitution. Because again, the legislature always may simply opt to apply the mens rea of recklessness to a circumstance instead of knowledge if it wants to premise liability on the mere conscious disregard of a risk. That's always an option the legislature has at its disposal. The question is then, when the legislature says, no, recklessness won't suffice, it's only going to be knowledge, nothing less, in what narrow set of circumstances can reckless conduct be fairly considered just as culpable as knowing conduct? And so it's not clear, or it seems less clear, let's say, that the mother described in that situation is equally culpable to the person who simply knowingly drives the drugs in their car. That's, and again, people's intuitions vary. You know, there's no scientific method here, but that is the general sense, assuming that the read of this language is right.
So in that example, mother doesn't want to look in a knapsack.
Right.
How would it be under criminal liability, and how would it be under circumstance exemption?
So under the USAO proposal, that person would count.
Would count as?
Willful, as deliberately ignorant, therefore not knowing.
Not looking in it, whereas the mother is not thinking about criminal liability at all, or even if it's a crime?
Right, or no, so, yeah, so let
because,
me just clarify one thing.
Says, because we'll right. get to primary in a minute.
Right.
So I need to be able to distinguish the two.
Right, no. So I would say it is implicit in having the purpose to avoid criminal liability is you know that it's
that
crime.
That is crime, right?
Right, that is true. Okay. That is how that operates. But with the question presented is whether or not in that hypothetical that the mother is as culpable as the knowing actor.
But the question is not as culpable. The question is culpable, right? Because we could debate whether as culpable, to me, as culpable may end up being a penalty discussion, not necessarily a liability discussion.
Well, but again, if the legislature rejects recklessness as a mens rea and selects knowledge instead as a mens rea, then the legislature is making a choice as to where that threshold should be. So then the question becomes, that's where the legislatures decide to set the threshold, what sets of unique circumstances can boost the reckless actor, otherwise excluded by the legislature's choice, to the equivalent culpability. And so that at least as far as staff understands it, is sort of the question that willful blindness doctrine is coming to ask. Because again, the legislature can just always decide to simply choose the mens rea of recklessness.
Or have a lesser included of recklessness. Right.
Right. I they mean, chose the grade. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But so it really
that's
is as culpable.
Yeah.
Right. And if you think, well, not really, but it's still not okay, then it could be a different offense.
It could be.
But it wouldn't
right.
be. But it's not a wrong question. In fact, it is the question that's being asked as culpable because it is right. a substitution.
It's a substitution, right? And it's a rule of substitution. And so the question is. Is this modification adequately reflect that substitution? And that's, you know, I guess that would be curious to know what
no.
people's thoughts are on that.
I think it's, I mean, whatever. It's not surprising. I went way the other direction. We went way the other direction. That's...
But and I guess
it's too low. It's not a substitution for knowledge. And I think that is the, sort of the important point. If you want it to be reckless when we get to an offense, then we'll argue over whether it should be reckless. But if we've chosen knowledge, it should be higher.
I mean,
so So that's just something that we're...
I mean, in a way, right? Like, every moment of every day, you are choosing to not investigate things because you do not want to know whether they exist, right? That is ever present in everything you do. You're always selecting away from things that you don't want to know about. And it seems like an exceedingly low bar, right? If you frame it as, I think it will open the door to a lot of debate about what falls under that. It is, I don't want to know what's in my email. But it's not because I think there's something criminal in my email. But if there is something criminal in my email, then I'm on the hook because I just didn't want to know what was in my email. I, didn't want to know what was in the birthday present.
But that's not the purpose of you not looking at it, is it?
I was delivering to somebody because I don't want to know, right, what's in the birthday present at all. But doesn't that mean that I don't want to know what it is, even if it happens to be explosives or drugs, right? It's not clear to me that that definition excludes even that. I think it is arguably... Now, obviously, that would not be prosecuted, but the fact that it wouldn't be prosecuted doesn't mean that it's not covered by that language. So I would say it's better to have language that more clearly demarcates the very specific nature of the forbidden circumstance.
So that's kind of one end and something that staff is thinking about. The question, so PDS's proposal kind of comes from an alternative angle and says that sort of the gist of the recommendation is that, well, I should just take a step back. The last CRAG meeting, there was some very interesting conversations, some novel points raised about, just mixed motives and the fact that people can have multiple purposes when they act. And so I think, like, I remember last meeting, there's some discussion of the bartender who doesn't ID someone who looks underage, both because, maybe they didn't want to know, or they wanted to avoid, violating law, but also because they were super busy, and how do we wrestle with the fact that that people act with multiple motives? A lot of the hypotheticals discussed last meeting, and I think which are driving the PDS proposal, involves situations where a purpose was to avoid criminal liability, but there was another purpose, and the other purpose was either neutral or praiseworthy. One something that kind of complicates it though is that it can also cut the other way. So, for example, in the bartender example, the one reason why the bartender may not have checked the ID of the underage person is to avoid liability in case there were undercover cops, busing people for selling to underage kids. But the other reason may have been because he actually had plans to sexually assault the underage looking bar afterwards, probably even more realistically in terms of how some of these conspiracies work. So let's imagine a situation where the same kind of standard drug mule situation, but if the person...
Just be more specific about what you're talking about in the drug mule context.
Sure, I'll read you.
Because that's the classic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's imagine an actor named Fred. Fred works a night shift at a warehouse, and he's heard rumors that boxes he spends his nights loading and unloading for the boss contain drugs and other contraband. His suspicions are strengthened when the boss starts giving him a weekly bonus. mostly in the form of goods, like watches, clothing, and appliances, for doing a good job and minding your own business. Fred realizes he could check whether the contents of the boxes are improper by lifting up the flaps, but not so much that the packing tape rips. However, this would still stretch the packing tape, and Fred thinks there is a chance that investigating this way might tip off the boss who is snooping. If the boss thinks Fred knows too much, the bonuses will stop, and Fred might lose his job. But Fred wants the bonuses, though, so he does not investigate. He also knows that by avoiding guilty knowledge, he'll have a defense in the case that the situation is discovered by police. So what we have here is somebody who has two different motives. One motive is to preserve a defense, and the other is to preserve the continued benefits of partaking in this arrangement. So let's assume, as in this hypothetical, that the primary purpose was to continue receiving benefits in this arrangement, but a secondary the secondary or non-primary purpose is to preserve a defense in case of liability.
But those are so inextricably linked in my view, because you don't have the purpose of continuing to get the bonuses unless you actually believe that the reason you shouldn't look is because there's something wrong about you looking, and that's why you're being paid off. I mean, those are...
Sorry, can you say that one more time?
Those seem too inextricably linked to have the discussion that I think we're trying to have, because it seems to me that poor Fred wants to, yes, he does want to keep the bonuses coming, but at the very same time he knows he's getting bonuses or payoffs because there's something not right about the contents of these boxes. And that is tied to probably illegal.
Right.
I'm wondering if there's a possibility of considering something where one of the motives is entirely innocent or innocuous.
Right, no, so yeah, so last week there were, I should preface by saying our last discussion, there were many situations given where the other one was innocent. So I think it was...
We sort of link the things together, right? Part of my concern the last time, and wrote about it in the comments, is it had to do with the probability, in a way, of whether what is going on is illegal, right? So my sort of being one of the reasons that I'm avoiding confirmation, it sort of pushes more, like, chances are that smell is actually associated with drugs, but it also could be, you know, I don't know, somebody's terrible cologne, or, you know, whatever, I don't know. That the sort of, like, chances are it's that, and so my avoiding that, even if it's one of many purposes, I should be on the hook. Whereas if it's not a super high probability, right, it could be this, but it could be, it's just as likely that it's five other things. And I'm just like, and I have a number of reasons for like, I'm rushed and I've got my mind somewhere else. And if it does happen to be that, that would be a probably could get in criminal trouble. Should I, when it's a low probability that it is the criminal thing, and I would have a number of reasons for not confirming it, am I as culpable as the person who knows? And because the sort of high probability thing got messy, that prong one was too hard to sort of distinguish, to have room between reckless as to whether the circumstance existed or something higher, we said, okay, our explanation was, okay, if we can't make one higher, so that it had to be highly probable that the circumstance existed, then it ought to be a primary purpose. And I will say this, it's not like I previewed this for Katja, so she can kick me. It's not even that primary, I wish I had a word that was like, leading candidate. You know, like, it doesn't even have to be the top thing, but, like, among the top
modal
things.
So let me say...
What?
Modal?
Yeah.
No.
Not modal.
So Laura, let me say this. So we did a little bit of research because we figured, look, like, there are a lot of uses of the phrase "with the purpose" used throughout the criminal law. How is this dealt with? And so what some preliminary poking around found is that for many, and again, this is not necessarily in the willful blindness context. This is just generally how do courts deal with the problem of mixed criminal motives. The general approach seems to be to adopt a substantial motivating factor test. And so, you know, it's ambiguous, but it's got to have some, you know, significant import. And I would say one of the leading cases, it was a New York Court of Appeals case. It was addressing the issue of mixed motives in a first-degree murder statute that was for the purpose of eliminating a witness. And I should note that the district, for our sentencing of first-degree murder, one of the aggravating factors is something along those lines, something similar.
In the district.
And so the defendant argued that he couldn't be found liable because the state had to prove that he killed the victim for the sole purpose of preventing the victim's testimony. In other words, claiming that proof of any motive for the murder other than his desire to prevent the victim's testimony would exonerate him. The court rejected that argument, as well as an argument by the prosecution that would have permitted a conviction when a defendant's motivation to eliminate a witness is insubstantial or merely incidental. Instead, the court adopted a rule that would permit a first-degree murder conviction when a defendant possessed mixed motives, so long as the defendant's motivation to eliminate the victim as a witness was a substantial factor in murdering her. So, again, this is just some preliminary research, but it seems like the courts that have dealt with that.
Have you turned that into a proposal?
No.
So this is like this is one of the stickiest parts of criminal law, is how you limit the extent of knowledge, and especially in a transactional economy, right, where lots of people are entering into transactions that have varying degrees of innocence and guilt with parties that they know to various degrees. So you have, you know, someone who is selling telephone services to someone who might be a bookie, and they might, are the telephone services going to be used for bookmaking, or they're selling lingerie to someone who is a sex worker, is the lingerie going to be, and they're the various statutes that incriminate the assistance with various types of things, especially drugs, is something that you know, courts have wrestled with a lot. So there's no perfect answer, but that sounds to me like the substantial motivation.
Yeah.
Well, just to be clear, nothing in the district with regard to willful blindness, right? Like, there's just nothing here right now.
And
frankly, even I think from what Michael's able to find on willful blindness, just on that, in other jurisdictions, also nothing so far.
Or on the mixed motives,
On
mixed motives.
It comes up in these other contexts, like, again, our the murder statute, it's, you know, murder was committed for hire, for the purpose of avoiding or preventing a lawful arrest or effecting an escape from custody. You know, like, we have those kinds of things. And again, you know, it's in some ways similar, particularly that last, you know, for the purpose of avoiding or preventing a lawful arrest, you know. So, right, court reasoning on that may be analogous, but that's what we're dealing with, is analogies here. And I will say, you know, Michael could talk much more about kind of, you know, where the expert legal literature has gone on this, and it's gone way too, like, in detail about how you distinguish motives, right? It becomes like philosophy, right? You know, and psychology. And Mike, correct me, but you know, there's not an obvious answer that arises from this that is clean enough, direct enough, that it's well suited for a code. So there's no
Right.
There's no obvious answer.
I mean, you know, we could put a statement in the commentary that would say something to the effect of the purpose of preserve a defense must be primary, or if not primary, then a substantial factor accompanied by some other highly unjustifiable purpose.
See, the reason I don't like primary is it assumes even the actor themselves has a preference.
Yeah.
So if it's juxtaposed, there's two reasons I'm doing it, then the person gets off even if they're equal.
Well, and I think, you know, practically,
and that doesn't strike
people don't
and
usually
let
think
alone,
this way, right?
No, but like, let alone how do you prove that, forgetting about how you even get into the person's head to know which of the two is the is the primary.
What about substantial motivating factor?
I could live with that better. But quite honestly, when I look at the three, if I had a vote today, I'd vote for the original thing, because I think that strikes the balance between the two. But I'm not saying that we can, you know, we can't discuss other kinds of changes.
It's a little bit difficult for me right here, right now, trying to solve it, because it's not clear to me that we are not conflating two things, and that's the mixed purposes issue and what our office was very specifically trying to get to, and that is, I think everybody agrees, we don't have there's no requirement that we prove that the person knew the illegality of it. And so we're very specifically trying to target what we saw as that issue. You know, and obviously now with the other issue, as ministers of justice, we clearly would be concerned about something that was that is going to target conduct that we are not intending to target. So...
Yeah, so I actually, so Dave also raised the sort of being, at least as I recall, being concerned that it was slightly different. It wasn't on this point, but a concern about that clarify the types of mistakes or ignorance of law to which this applies, right? This aware that the act itself was illegal. That there was a concern that the government not have to prove we're aware. So I sort of saw your comments as linked. You just found the problems in different places. And it strikes me, we have yet to talk about Dave's point, but it might be helpful in sort of responding to you, Renata. I think in this circumstance where we're saying this person doesn't know, when are we going to, for a crime where we say you must know of this circumstance, when do we say, I don't care that you didn't actually know, you're going to jail for as long as the person who did know? And I think that's a really different thing than normally saying that the government shouldn't have to prove that a person... Hey, Chanel.
Sorry, guys. I'm talking to our staff. Excuse me.
Okay. That's not the same as Dave's concern of a larger all the time you have to prove that a defendant knew that what they were doing was illegal. This is like, you are right. That is implied here. But it is implied here for a reason, because it is the reason why I had it in my mind. I am not asking what's in the package, right, from the person who says, just carry this across the border, because I'm like, shit, this could be something that could get me in trouble. And that makes me as guilty as the person who's like, oh, is this our normal kilo of cocaine I'll be taking across the border? I should go to jail, and I'm like, I'm just not even going to ask. But not, it could be anything, you know, whatever. Do you see the distinction?
So to get, and I agree with you, but that's, I only, when I brought up the primary juxtapose, it was in the context of your comment.
Right.
So that's not to say that I don't necessarily agree that leaving primary out of the statement, but putting in a statement like what you were saying, but not using the word primary in a statement to make it clear.
So substantial.
So that might be that's
talking about.
That's
right. Yeah, I think. I think there's like at least one sentencing statute that I've I've seen a model for you know.
I agree. It should be a substantial factor. I'm just not saying how do you know, you right. know, among two substantial factors, which is primary.
Right. Yeah.
I have felt, even since I first suggested, even at the last meeting, I thought it's not really primary. I could live without primary because that does make it seem like. Like it has to be the number one reason. When I don't, I'm perfectly happy with substantial.
Yeah.
But if it's low on the list, I've got other really compelling reasons, and okay, it did cross my mind. I don't think that person is as culpable, and I wanted that distinction.
So, Michael, let's make one quick point. So, to add with the purpose to avoid criminal liability, I think someone said that implies that you know
right.
that this would be illegal. I don't know if that's logically true. I mean, even if you suspect that something is illegal. That would be enough to act with purpose to avoid criminal liability, right? So, like, adopting either the original proposal or PDS is not tantamount to requiring knowledge of law.
I mean, right, knowledge in this sort of straight, in the as defined in the general part. But, yes, one wouldn't try to preserve a defense for a crime that one was not at least aware of a possibility.
No,
a
possibility,
it,
right.
Yes,
you have to be
yes.
practically certain, for sure.
Yes.
For sure.
That's
but
true.
You could turn out to be the wrong offense.
The
problem isn't the kilo
yeah.
of, or what might be in the package.
Right.
It turns out brown paper this week
that's
is
right.
like, that's the problem.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
Okay, so. Brown paper you can see, so, but,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that was that was what staff at least wanted to discuss with respect to the deliberate ignorance.
Other thoughts before we move on, or
other thoughts about
this particular one? Okay.
Yeah.
So where are we?
Yeah,
I
think what we kind of said we wanted to also just finish up our research, right? Like in other words,
okay.
like you know, like partly on this, and then you know we'll come back and make another proposal and
okay.
another draft, like and you know right. I don't know. We'll see if the research turns out anything more. Yeah,
and you know it's a useful to keep this in mind when we move forward to specific offenses because you know at least some of the
right.
issues raised seem to suggest well you know the threshold mens rea perhaps you know reckless versus knowledge versus so
that's
it
right.
worth keeping all that in mind.
Can I ask too just as a matter of practice like to the extent this might come up. Is really have you seen any of this outside of like the drug context or like are these really is this really like most likely to come up in drug
happens a lot on white collar but that goes federal
right
yeah
so we don't yeah
I've
don't
never seen
that
it
yeah.
which is why I'm having trouble with it
yeah so and because again like you know look to the extent it's very focused on white collar or drug offenses again like well seeing how we parse out again is it going to be knowledge is it going to be recklessness well that would help you know.
What?
It just may be a non-issue.
So we're talking possession stuff, right? Like it's going to be true of guns and things like that, right? I had no idea.
I just don't know how much it comes
right.
up or, you know, like it's just as a, you know, anecdotally, I guess.
Or good. UV, right?
Yes.
Well, that's the case. The one DCCA case.
Receipt of stolen property.
Is RSP.
RSA.
But again, we don't know yet because we don't know what the mental state
right,
is
exactly.
that we're
so,
attaching
so,
to those.
So, it's,
right,
you
but
know,
in terms of like,
if it was
right.
knowledge,
yeah.
then
exactly.
this
world.
Would come up. That's
yeah.
right.
So, it's just to
right.
say, like, whatever we come up with here in second draft, like, it's something to continue to test going forward. And it might be that there's particular friction in a particular offense
yeah.
down the road. And, you know, so
it's
we can
the new
address
should
that.
Have knowns, right?
Those
this
are,
plays,
those are
this
be interesting.
Plays in
yes.
and the should have known.
Yes. Yes.
If you knew, this doesn't come up.
Right.
That's right.
Then
that's
you
right.
have knowledge
that's
by
right.
definition.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, DCCA is reckoned.
But it's
wrestled
not
with
just
that.
Should have
known.
Known.
Well,
I'm
not saying
they,
it's only should have known.
No, so what happened in so,
that's
so,
right.
so the 24th
is a subset of should have known.
What you do with should have known.
Yeah,
right.
so in one, in the 2014 decision, like Gall. Owens or yeah I think it's a you know what the DCCA was interpreting the having reason
to believe
yeah. and said well that can't mean negligence because that would be you know disproportionate and negligence liability isn't typically negligence is typically the base for criminal liability so what we're going to do is we're going to read this as referring to willful blindness so therefore the government needs to prove either new or
yeah.
willfully blind.
So we clearly know what the issue is.
Yep.
To the extent that USAODC has anything in the interim to share, we will with the group. And if you could share your research with us so that we have
sure.
that and
sure.
the ability to consider it before the next meeting so that we can be ready.
You bet.
That's all it asks.
yeah, so the second issue worth thought would be helpful to have a group discussion on is the correspondence between intoxication and negligence. OAG and PDS are not necessarily coming from different sides, actually, but so first of all, the OAG approach, and I can only call it approach because OAG just made a comment
yeah.
or said we should explicitly clarify something. They did not propose statutory language to do this. And you know, yeah, so just to be clear, what we're talking about here, broader context, is Section 209B goes through for purpose, knowledge, and recklessness, and clarifies. It's a purely descriptive provision. When, as a matter, as an empirical matter, when can intoxication negate a person's culpable mental state? Purpose, knowledge, and recklessness are all subjective forms of culpability that require an actual thought or perception in the person's mind, and so it goes through and just clarifies that, for example, intoxication negates purpose when, due to the person's intoxicated state, the person doesn't consciously desire a particular outcome, and so on and so forth. What it leaves open is what the relationship between intoxication and negligence is. So OAG's recommendation is to just explicitly to clarify straightforward, a person's intoxication does not negate the culpable mental state of negligence. So the issue or question there is, you know, so there's two forms of intoxication. There's self-induced and non-self-induced or involuntary intoxication. I think, you know, most people would agree that when the intoxication is involuntary, so for example, someone spikes someone's drink at a fraternity party, and then they commit a crime, and the standard is negligence, that when we are, that first of all, being involuntarily intoxicated, it's not, well, but it's not a 100% exculpation, it's when you are determining whether the gross deviation standard has been met, the reasonable person then is the reasonable person in precisely the same situation as the person who is involuntarily intoxicated. Where it's self-induced intoxication, conversely, it seems like there is that PDS agrees that in that situation, when you're determining whether the gross deviation standard has been met, that self-induced intoxication is not something that gets considered, and in that sense is irrelevant to negligence liability.
So that is your position, that you agree that self-induced.
Yeah. We just sort of felt like people would look for it. You do that. You had the sort of other three mental states or whatever, and clearly there's something to be said about negligence, and we just sort of thought people would look for it, and so yes, this that's, and so what it seemed is it had to do with not being self-induced.
Right.
But if it's self-induced, and there's the rub, what's the difference? But yes, that's our position.
So I guess the first
just to check too. So, and that is where you were coming from too,
yeah.
right? Like when your comment was about the self-induced case.
Yeah.
Just to
I was not dealing with
involuntary.
With involuntary. I was only talking about.
Right. So I think on the same page with that.
Yeah.
That's right.
So
great. So with that in mind, what you have here is a potential staff proposal. Hopefully a little bit clearer, a little bit more direct route to clarifying what we just spoke about. There's two pieces to it. One is the sort of general point that intoxication negates negligence when the person's conduct does not constitute a gross deviation from the standard of care the reasonable person would observe in the person's situation. That language is taken directly from the definition of negligence. And the second sentence is explicitly states self-induced intoxication may not be taken into consideration in determining whether a person's conduct constitutes a gross deviation.
Okay, if you could just let us read it for a minute.
This note reads so differently than the others.
Right.
I mean, the benefit of the PDS proposal is it actually reads exactly like the others.
Yeah.
So that when you get there, you get the terms of what we're right. talking, right?
So one issue or one question with the PDS proposal is, you know, so Richard, can you pull up the recklessness? It basically states the same thing as the recklessness one.
Is it down below, or is it just on
no,
off of
the general? Yeah, yeah.
Just a minute.
It's 209B3.
But it sort of then shows how they sort of work together.
Right.
That's how I actually kind of figure out how to.
Yeah, the problem is it's a little asymmetric in its. This computer's got
scrolling. Scrolling for a group is like a high stakes proposition.
It really is.
You know, it's hard to please.
Yeah, it's like the grown up version of party foul. You know.
All right. So there we go. The this is again
party foul.
Comparable
mental state.
Sorry. Let me pull it up a little bit. So.
When?
Whoa.
Sorry.
Listen,
it's right
there.
A bit. Yes, but
we're missing the line.
Oh, Lord.
So there we go.
Trying to get it all so we don't have the. Oh, that's not going to help, is it? What mode do I want?
It's right.
Web layout?
Stop. Just make it smaller.
It's right there, but smaller?
Yeah, I think that'll help.
Try. Well, then it doesn't like that. Sorry, let me try one more thing. Appreciate your patience.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, there's what we want.
Oh. Okay.
Don't touch it.
Right.
Don't touch it.
This may be stressing me. Can you
put
the staff recommendation under it so I can look at the two together?
Just, you know.
I know you get it better.
I've been looking forward to this all day.
I have a difficulty here.
I actually made them get me a second screen so I can do this stuff side by side. I can't work otherwise.
The two screens.
The two screen method. Right.
Chanel, that's a budget item.
We finalized all our recommendations.
Too late. All right. And do we want the PDS one below, or we'll see?
Do Paul and Chanel have this language? That
so
we're
they have this language, and the other one was in the compilation. Although it might be, they might be having the same difficulties I have.
They know where to find it in this stuff.
I hope so. So just to be clear, for Paul and Chanel, so we're looking at. 209B, just in the compilation document that was gone out, but just our, or the report itself. But we're just, again, comparing the current language that we have for purpose, knowledge and recklessness in 209B with the proposal in the document I just sent for negligence.
Great. Okay, thanks.
And let me find... Okay, so we want this.
Are you
going to
windows?
I know. How do I split the windows?
Or just copy and paste into a single document?
Oh.
No?
Split.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Why don't you just pick
them
up and
put them in? Michael's right. The simplest way is to just...
Yeah. Copy and paste.
Fine. I think we just want
that's
that.
Good. That's fine. That's good. We can remember that.
All right. Let me
do this
a little
that.
Bit bigger. Scroll up. And great. It's a small print. Fanciness. There we go. Helpful, I can kind of...
No. What I was thinking was, it seems strange that we put self not self-induced in with all the others, but we break out self-induced as its own section,
right,
which seems almost backwards. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
in other words, I mean, knowledge, it's something you're doing. And we put that in with not self-induced. It seems almost as if you should either put the self-induced in with that and deal with the non-self-induced, or have negligence, an A and a B, with self-induced and non-self-induced. Structurally.
Sure. Yeah, that might well make sense, because, again, self-induced, we aren't otherwise...
Self-induced is like the odd man out, as opposed to the typical, like, knowledge.
That's right. Negligence is just different with respect to that, because, right.
But in self-induced, the common conduct or circumstance...
Which is why I think it belongs with recklessness and knowledge.
Rather than having it in recklessness, having this reference to unless that person's conduct satisfies C, and you break it out like that.
Sorry, I'm not following.
My suggestion is either to say for negligence.
Right.
Recklessness. Oh, no, negligence, I'm sorry. For negligence, A, self-induced, B, not self-induced.
Just organizationally. Just label them slightly different.
Or have self-induced as number four in a separate paragraph, the non-self-induced, because that's where the person is not acting at all due to their own behavior, due to their own, like, knowledge and kind of thing. All I'm saying is, in my mind, it should either be in one paragraph or flipped.
Got it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if others think that would be helpful or not. You know, this again goes to the point. Some of this could go in commentary, right? Like, you know, all of this before we had in commentary, right? And it was your comments that kind of thought, hey, it would be helpful,
right,
to flesh this out, what's going on in negligence. And
I was just saying structurally, I could live with it.
But that's another.
So I was just saying, like, Laura's proposal is the intuitive one, and it would be, like, preferable if it could be preserved. The problem, and I stare at it for a long time, to try and figure out why doesn't it work. Why is it that it basically says the same thing as the recklessness one says? So, because it's when due to the person's intoxicated state, the person is not aware, or when due to that person's intoxicated state, the person failed to perceive. Yeah. It's two ways of saying the same thing. So I was trying to figure, do you disagree with that, Laura?
Wait, the first part of both is the same, right?
Negates
the existence.
What you did was totally intuitive and totally reasonable, which is just to plug in the language from the first part of the definition of negligence in the same structure as purpose, knowledge, and recklessness did. And that's totally intuitive and organization seems like the right way.
Why is it legally wrong?
It ends up saying the same thing as the recklessness. So to say that when due to the person's intoxicated state, the person is not aware of a substantial risk, and to say when due to the person's intoxicated state, that person failed to perceive a substantial risk,
right,
are two ways of saying the same thing.
In negligence, their intoxication wasn't self-induced. You're right. It's the same. But it cancels negligence when their intoxication wasn't self-induced. If it was,
right,
recklessness, that's how those tie together.
Yeah.
So there's
two pieces.
Yes.
One, and this is true with respect to recklessness as well, so this highlighted, you know, potentially a broad array of issues, to say with respect to recklessness, it's not just the failure, the part of the recklessness definition which says fail to perceive a substantial risk is almost secondary to the requirement that the person's conduct constitute a gross deviation. because the gross deviation requirement of negligence is primary. And so, and as a matter of practice, when courts are dealing with this, the question is, when we are dealing with the gross deviation, when we're trying to figure out whether this is grossly unreasonable, what is the role that intoxication plays in how we make that comparison?
What?
So
you in no way explained.
Yeah,
that.
Maybe
I assume the intoxication had to do with the, with whether I was aware of the substantial risk and whether it ties in down here.
Right.
It's not about how I then conducted myself. This your proposal doesn't not make sense to me, but it's only because you did a whole intro about it.
Are you saying, Mike, that the way it's current? See, that's why I thought the structure was important. C, as it's currently drafted, only applies to recklessness.
That's right.
Because for negligence, you're saying you have to look at whether it's a gross deviation from the standard, which is different from failing to perceive a substantial risk.
Yeah. So here's the thing: is that there's really two aspects. And again, this is a challenge when you really want to fully clarify something through a statute. There's two aspects to recklessness. One, did the person consciously disregard a substantial risk? And two, was the person's conduct a gross deviation? As a matter of practice, both of those, involuntary intoxication could be relevant to both of those. So involuntary intoxication could explain A. Right? It may be the case that the person was involuntarily intoxicated, that they consciously disregarded a substantial risk, but their conduct still wasn't a gross deviation, because when you look at the circumstances as a whole, the reasonable person involuntarily intoxicated would nevertheless have consciously disregarded that risk as well. And so to be fully comprehensive, the recklessness should really say both, one, when due to that person's intoxicated state, the person's not aware of a substantial risk as it is, or two, due to that person's intoxicated state, their conduct doesn't constitute a gross deviation. So there's really...
Did you say due to their intoxicated state?
Right, exactly. Well, because there's two...
Despite their intoxicated state.
No, due to the person's intoxicated state, the person's conduct does not constitute a gross deviation. So, I'll give you an example.
Right? Isn't it just like, because I am drunk.
I agree.
No, by the way, forget what I said before. I now understand.
It's extremely complicated. And so, you know.
So when, because I'm drunk, am I not grossly deviating?
Right. So the person who is involuntarily intoxicated goes to a frat party, drinks out of the punch bowl, or is someone puts a roofie in her drink. The roofie gives her less of an ability to, let's say, account for the interests of others. So she may thereafter go do something. For example, get in the car, drive, and she may even be aware and conscious of a risk of harm, but even notwithstanding all that, because of her involuntarily intoxicated state, whatever harm ends up resulting, you still might hold that under the circumstances, her conduct did not constitute a gross deviation from a state, or was not grossly unreasonable under the circumstances.
This is the point from earlier, not because on an objective scale of reasonable conduct or grossly deviating.
Grossly unreasonable, let's just say. Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
It's whether you get to, whether the person you're judging it against is a drunk person or a sober person.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. So what is key to what you said is involuntary.
That's right.
Right. Which is why we're down here talking about self-induced.
which...
Right, because you were talking about recklessness. That's why you say that's how you are drawing non-self-induced intoxication
right.
as the exception. That's how you draw it into recklessness.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
Okay.
But there's action, but there, for self-induced, there is an additional piece that is not clarified, which, if it were included, perhaps would make it look more parallel to the staff proposal.
Which is, if it's self-induced intoxication,
that's right.
then...
No, which is that either due to the person's intoxicated state, they were not aware of a substantial risk, thereby precluding the government from proving prong one of recklessness, or because due to their intoxicated state, even if the person was consciously disregarded risk, the government can't prove that the person's conduct was grossly unreasonable.
Right.
So
where you go on to explain the way you decide whether it's grossly unreasonable is whether it's self-induced or not self-induced.
That what I would say is in evaluating whether or not the person's conduct is grossly unreasonable, when it is self-induced, you exclude that. It's not something that gets considered in your calculus, but where it is involuntary, and bear with me, I know this is extraordinarily complicated, then it would be considered. It would be relevant to the fact finder's overall consideration as to whether or not the person's conduct is grossly unreasonable. So by leaving that out, by leaving that piece out, and what you end up with is the potential staff proposal ends up looking a lot less congruous to the other. I would just say one additional point. I think one thing that, because again, I stared at this for a really long time and tried to figure out like what was it that seemed a little bit off. One thing that this may highlight is that the definition of negligence is missing potentially a key clause,
yeah.
which is the prong one of negligence currently reads something like the person failed to perceive a substantial risk. It probably should say the person's failed to perceive a substantial risk that he or she should have been aware of. Because if you put that language in, then it reads a little bit less. The problem seems to disappear a little bit in terms of with PDS's proposal. But there's something about just saying that person failed to perceive a substantial risk without any mention of should have been aware, and then in terms of how you go beyond that and deal with gross deviation, that may be problematic.
So can just back up again and kind of say like, look, this is rare stuff, right? Like the idea that the gross deviation portion,
right.
which is what you know we're really concerned about here, in involuntary intoxication cases, is going to make a difference. I mean that's what we're kind of gaming all of this around, right? Is how to add language to deal with that. It might come up. It's a legitimate question.
Well, you could have that in the context of the frat.
Absolutely.
Frat party.
Yeah.
Or frat initiation or whatever it was in Pennsylvania that goes awry because some of the people are voluntarily intoxicated. Perhaps some of the other pledges may have been involuntarily intoxicated.
That's right. No, this can come up. I guess I just want to back up to the general point. Is this something... look, we've spent a lot of time puzzling over this. There's going to be more time because, right, to flesh this out, again, Michael's suggesting we kind of have fill out recklessness has two prongs, and it's dealing both with the, failure to be aware of the risk and then also adding in something new regarding gross deviation and then, you know, doing both of those, addressing both of those prongs for negligence. We could do this. We could go down this road, and we could do that in the next draft. The alternative is to kind of back off of it and, for instance, stick with kind of what we did with recklessness there, only kind of do the main portion, not address in the statute the involuntary intoxication with gross deviation, you know, just like and leave that to commentary.
So I would try to introduce.
Yeah, please.
I should also say we can also just adopt. We go with PDS's proposal. This is sufficient.
I like the idea of fixing negligence. If you've perceived a deficiency with negligence,
yeah,
that does seem.
Yeah.
No.
That makes sense. I. You don't have to choose mine.
Well, I guess.
But yours doesn't make. If I were trying to read that statute and understand, I would get to yours and be like, "Where the fuck did that come from?" Because it doesn't. It's not the. yes, people know we talk.
Yeah. So.
So that's. But so like.
In the John A. Wilson Building. No one swears.
Actually, okay. Anyway. But if you brought some of that stuff up earlier, I just wouldn't, it would take me so long to puzzle out that one thing. But I do feel like we have to say something about negligence.
Yeah, definitely.
Or people are going to be, not just in commentary, like in the statute.
In the statute.
And the most important part,
so
I say two things. One, you know, all of this could go in commentary because I'm not saying it should. I'm just saying, you know, to the extent that these things are, while it only makes sense or it's only fully comprehensive with an introduction, that, you know, and it's a descriptive thing, then that perhaps would be an indicator that it is better addressed in commentary. That aside, to me, the most important point is that just that for negligence, self-induced intoxication does not get considered when you are evaluating the gross deviation standard, and everything else, you know, could be helpful on, you know, in the outer boundaries, but, you know, and right, so because C2 straight up requires for all self-induced recklessness imputation proof of negligence, like, you know, I think it's definitely something worth clarifying because it's because it's fundamental. So the question is how to do it, and I think everyone agrees here on the basic policy point. So, you know, to the extent that there's agreement amongst you guys as to what most clearly articulates that policy point, then, you know, just let us know, because, you know, whatever.
So I maybe give two choices. The one being, I think, either kind of recklessness as is. The PDS version in parallel for negligence. You can check, again, the kind of earlier definition of negligence as well. Just go with that. They're parallel. It covers the main point. Or we flesh out both the recklessness and negligence prongs so that they are both parallel.
Can we see what that looks like?
Okay. Okay. If you're interested in that, then we'll...
Yeah.
We'll, because that is the...
When you do that, may I suggest that you use a
split screen,
a method that we used to use, and that is
old school.
For each one is going to be in a separate sheet of page. On the left side, you're going to have recklessness, and then on the right hand side, you're going to have the other, and then you're going to have a separate one for negligence, and then on the right hand side, what that looks like.
Yeah, so we can, like, in the next version of this, or we might even do some interim thing and just, like, circulate a draft to kind of get, you know, take the temperature on, like, look, are we going with the full-blown version, and we just really got to, like, work to, like, make it as approachable as possible, or we push into commentary some of this, the concerns about particularly...
Yeah.
The gross disproportionality.
This is just a draft.
But it sounds like, okay. So we'll put the next version we get to you. We'll have a couple of options for this then, so you can kind of weigh this, and, you know, maybe you'll agree, maybe you won't, but like that'll move us forward on it. But it sounds like, again, on the policy point we're agreed. So like that's. Huge, because, you know, then we can, you know, continue to move forward.
Can I ask one more question before you do that?
Yeah.
Maybe you can address this when you send up the email.
Throw the ball. What do you got?
What is
No, just the extent of what you're thinking of moving into commentary.
Gotcha. Yes, exactly. We will. Okay. That's right. Because it, with the skinnier version, the like, you know, recklessness as it is now, and the PDS version of negligence, what would need to then go into commentary to address these remaining points?
I should just note that if the phrase, and again, this is just my reading, I'm not saying it's right reading, if the clause failed to perceive a substantial risk of which the person should have been aware is added to the definition of negligence, and then that language is parroted here, the problem appears less significant, that in terms of just going with PDS's approach. That being said, I feel like there would still be a benefit from just stating the key point, which is that self-induced intoxication doesn't get considered when evaluating the gross deviation standard. So,
good. I think great. Good for now. Good for now. Thank you, Michael.
So there's one more point to discuss. So PDS's recommendation was to codify a definition of self-induced intoxication, and the recommendation is well taken. I think PDS makes a persuasive point that this is important enough and central enough to the operation of the code, and you know, who else to clarify but the legislature? So PDS's proposal is based on the Model Penal Code with one tweak. You'll note that the Model Penal Code, the sort of first clause, up until the word unless, is identical between the Model Penal Code and PDS. The difference is what follows afterwards. The MPC provides two exceptions. One is pursuant to medical advice, and the other is a kind of catch-all under such circumstances that would afford a defense to a charge of crime. The PDS proposal would preserve the under circumstances as would afford a defense to a charge of crime piece, but it would get rid of the pursuant to medical advice piece. The sort of the rationale is, or the sort of what's envisioned is, the person who is prescribed opioids or benzodiazepam and has it prescribed for a legitimate purpose, but then abuses it and goes on to commit crimes. Whether that sort of, while the substance is prescribed, it's being used in a kind of different way, how to deal with that. And so PDS proposal is to get rid of the Model Penal Codes, the medical advice clause, and then add a sentence which is, intoxication is not self-induced if it occurs as an unforeseen result of medication taken pursuant to medical advice. So the implication there, it seems to be, and I ask you this, Laura, is that when someone takes medication and knows it has an intoxicating offense, then that categorically, that form of intoxication could never be, is basically irrelevant for purposes of dealing with self-induced intoxication.
That it was prescribed does...
Right, doesn't get you off.
Right.
Doesn't get you off.
Right.
Right. And so the only question, the sort of general issue staff wants to raise is that might be, potentially overly harsh. And I'll just give you some examples that might clarify why that would be.
So
PDS's proposal is, potentially more government friendly than the Model Penal Code. But part of that depends upon.
You look at me, you know I like you. You know, okay, let's see.
Yeah, so.
But before you go on,
this is actually
the underlying provision of the PDS.
That tells you something. She did that really quickly. And I will not use the word that we do not like, but she certainly
Never mind.
Yeah. So.
Sorry.
So now with the model penal code, the phrase "pursuant to medical advice" is kind of ambiguous, but it at least as interpreted from PDS would seem to suggest a sort of categorical: if it's prescribed, it can never be self-induced. Or sorry, it can never be involuntary. The PDS proposal, I think, it is attempting to kind of like narrow it more appropriately. The question is, so for, I'll give you an example, give me a sense of whether this should qualify as self-induced or involuntary intoxication. So mother...
Guys, this is Paul. I got to sign off. Sorry to leave early, but I'll see you guys next time.
Thank you, Paul. Take care.
Bye-bye.
So, yeah, imagine a mother takes a prescribed opioid at home, consistent with doctor's orders, and thereafter trips down the stairs and ends up killing her toddler, who's located at the bottom of the stairs. If prosecuted for reckless or negligent homicide, should that parent be able to present evidence of her intoxicated state as evidence that her conduct was not grossly grossly unreasonable?
The toddler had been smoking weed, though, right?
Yeah.
So the toddler, you just got back from the ice cream party.
Legal weed. Yeah. So the general rule appears to be that when and again, this is just based upon preliminary research, but the general rule appears to be that at least when it is both pursuant to and in accordance with medical advice, then it is involuntary intoxication and it would be treated as such. So as like the Wisconsin Supreme Court explained it, when faced with medical condition requiring drug treatment, the patient hardly has a choice but to follow the doctor's orders. Intoxication resulting from such compliance with a physician's advice should not be deemed voluntary just because the patient is aware of potential adverse side effects. We agree with the Texas court. We agree with the Texas court's formulation of when involuntary intoxication is at issue, which includes medically prescribed drugs taken according to prescription. We note that this does not include cases where a patient knowingly takes more than the prescribed dosage or mixes a prescription medication with alcohol or other controlled substances. Neither would the defense be available to one who voluntarily undertakes an activity incompatible with the drug's side effects. So the recommendation would be, again, it's how people may have conflicting intuitions, but an alternative proposal would be to basically keep the model penal code language on medical advice, but add an additional clause which is pursuant to and in accordance with medical advice, and that being the means for...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No.
The reason, I mean, I sort of like the unforeseen result in one way, and I sort of had a notation in for commentary that it's not an unforeseen result if the medication, if the intoxication is a known effect or side effect of it, which is something that you just included with the side effect, but which I don't see in the staff proposal. So let's say you're taking it pursuant to in accordance with medical advice, but that information sheet that goes along with it says if you do this and have a cup of coffee,
right?
You know, don't touch anything that's sharp or is a heavy object because you're going to be, you know, completely intoxicated. How does that play out?
Yeah, so ought to attention? Know. So go up the clause before. So self-induced intoxication means intoxication caused by substances the person knowingly introduces, the tendency of which causes intoxication the person knows or ought to know.
Except when they take it, I mean...
Pursuant to...
Yeah. So I think this is like a straight up debatable issue, right? Like, you know, the fine print on prescriptions is very fine, right? Your doctor may have emphasized one, may have given you directions that had nothing to do because it's an off-label use, right, with how it's otherwise, you know, the pharmaceutical information on there. In a given situation, what is relevant? Right. I'm not sure we want to get into the details of, like, is it everything that was, you know.
Which is why I said something in the commentary, and I wasn't going to talk about the statute, where you say that if you're on notice, even if you're taking on medical advice, if you're on notice that the drug can have that particular effect, then the mere fact that you're, that it's prescribed, to me, should not be an excuse.
So let me ask you a question. So then the example I just gave, where a woman, anyone really, who's prescribed an opioid, right? So
she,
I think,
I don't understand what crime she committed. She tripped.
Right, she tripped.
Right.
I don't,
by accident or mistake, right?
So I just,
right. So,
can we
so
operate heavy machinery?
So
and run someone down?
Sure. Yeah,
it's
so
not
so
drunk driving where you're like,
yeah, I don't
have to be
that.
Drunk, so
right.
I stay away
but the,
from
so the thing is,
a blank
right.
car.
That is operating heavy machinery while intoxicated is arguably not in accordance with medical advice. Now you can add another clause on that says pursuant to in accordance with medical advice or something along the lines of what this Wisconsin court noted, which is in a manner that is not incompatible with its manner of usage. The only concern here being articulated was that people are prescribed drugs that have intoxicating effects. Now, we're all thinking about driving, right? And clearly,
nobody tells you not to walk around your house.
Right, exactly. So, that's exactly
so,
right.
So I guess it's just a question of what it means to be in accordance with.
Right.
Right.
And what is the scope of medical advice? Is it the
yeah.
prescription? Again, like, you know, the fine print goes on for sometimes, you
right.
know, pages,
right.
right? Like, is it every single possible, you know, thing that's listed there that you were, in some sense, on notice of because you got it, you know, at the pharmacy? Or is it a narrower set of, no, the doctor said these are the three things that you need to do? Or is it a, right, you know, cross medications, right? You're going
to. Or like, maybe a more realistic example. Maybe like a more realistic example.
You still want to define this?
Yeah.
I think
this is, the, you know, we've got the should or ought to, and in accordance with medical. I feel like everyone would agree this is in the zone. It's the question then of the
right,
contours
the
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the question, and I think it's a. It is a fair question whether we can or want to like get too specific on this or leave this up to judges.
No, that's
I know you're. I know you're.
I thought that was the antithesis.
Well, you know, at some point.
Yeah, no, I mean, I look, I.
Well, the only thing about medical advice is medical advice tends to be, you've got, you know, a liver issue. Take this pill. It's not. But don't take this other pill with it at the same time, even though had you read about it, you would have known that those two pills interact.
So I do know that when, like, you know, I'm thinking about, like, when I've had, like, serious surgery and you get prescribed, like, an opioid, it always says on the bottle something along the lines of, like, do not drive, do not
operate
heavy machinery.
That's why I said.
Which is what, so it's, you know, so... I think what you want, and again, this is just based, my intuitions may vary here. It seems to me that it's intuitive that when someone is therefore driving or operating heavy machinery, that
yes.
that would be considered.
That
you know,
even though they only took the prescribed amount, that was yeah. not in accordance with.
That's right.
Right.
Okay.
And so, and at the same time, where it's, you're just doing your normal stuff, which is like moving around the house or whatever, that you're out in the world, not operating machinery, not driving, and something happens, that in that situation, then, you know, so the
you turn too quickly while you're slicing the bagel and you lose control.
Right.
That's a little better than tripping down.
Because what may happen is the government may not.
Toddler's still dead. It's
you
just,
lose control of the knife?
Yeah.
One of these.
Oh, my.
Yeah, like that. I mean, okay, mine was
sort of like
had
a
more blood in it.
Situation.
But I never saw it.
Yeah.
That's right. All I want to make sure is that what you just said is somewhere written down what the importance of medical advice is. Because I think that statement is subject to a lot of different interpretations.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I agree.
And I would put out there, too, that, like, look, the level of culpability, like, back up to, like, you know, if you're a judge, you're, right, like, again, like, it's a rare interaction that was printed on the label, but it was it happened in a just... walking around the house,
like
you had some strange.
Like, put Q-tips in your ears. Like, if you're like, really, right? They do. They're
they
like,
do.
Do not put it in your ears.
Yeah.
Like, okay,
yeah.
That's some
yeah.
bullshit. You know,
yeah.
that's what we're
yeah.
doing.
Yeah.
yeah.
So if it's like that kind of thing on the label,
right.
that doesn't count.
Right. Well, so I would just put it out there that there's like there's going to be cases
on
that push this. I think we could agree that like the heavy machinery, right, and where it's on, you know. what they put in the prescription bottle, they usually have like maybe like two or three reminders, right? Like for the most important things, you know?
Right.
But then, yeah, again, then there's the other sheet that has like, oh, well, all the other stuff. So, you know, in different situations, again, kind of from an overall kind of culpability perspective, right, there's the pure technical notice. There was some transmission of that information that you could have been aware of. And at the other end is the kind of like obvious stuff that everybody, you know, should have been aware of. The gray zone in between,
so where
do we really want to? Do we really want to?
But it does, because the gray zone comes up. You take Ambien, you have a shot of vodka.
Yeah.
It's going to affect you a lot differently, and that stuff happens all the time.
Absolutely.
Or maybe five shots of vodka. One shot is not necessarily going to get you anywhere.
I mean, it's easy enough to stay through commentary. So, for example, in like this Wisconsin edition I read from, you know, there's the general statutory requirement, and then case law has noted that this does not include cases where a patient knowingly takes more than prescribed dosage, or mixes a prescription medication with alcohol or other controlled substances, and it's not available when a person voluntarily undertakes an activity incompatible with the drug side effects.
I like that.
Right.
That's what I was
would
saying.
Would that get
in the commentary?
Is that enough? Like,
yes, for me it is. Good. I mean, subject to rereading all it is.
Sure.
Together.
But statute in this form, with that much in the commentary, no, that much? That seems like a middle path that might work? Okay.
Cool.
For now, I mean,
let's give me an example of the or a forward.
So, what's envisioned?
Tourette's, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Would you say Tourette's?
Tourette's.
Oh, Tourette's.
That I've never mentioned yourself, but it's possible.
And why do you change language afford a defense to afford a justification or excuse
that was gonna
defense
be,
to a charge?
Yeah, so that was going to be the final point I wanted to make is so the language as would afford a defense to a charge of crime is the same in the MPC and the PDS. It's just a small little clarificatory note. As Laura noted, that would include, like, for instance, intoxication by duress would count as involuntary. But the justification or excuse modifiers, so like you can imagine an offense that was being intoxicated in public, and what would be a defense is I was intoxicated at home. So, but that doesn't mean that home intoxication somehow constitutes it's a very, very narrow point, and if you think it's going to confuse more than it clarifies, you know, can leave it out. It's just highlighting, because there are failure of proof offenses and there's like general defenses like excuses and justifications, and what the model penal code is getting at is these like lesser evils and duress, and so it's just this might is a little bit clearer, but again, not just a technical note.
No concerns about that point.
Why don't we all review the whole package?
Yeah, no, well, exactly.
So we'll
that's right. There's going to be multiple, revisions. So for the next draft, but I think this is great. Let me just say, too, because we're getting towards the end of the time.
After I read all that stuff,
after I read everything. I actually wanted to kind of, if possible, quickly move on to one other comment on rule of lenity. And just quickly check in on that, because whatever chapter it was now, chapter two, the kind of rules of interpretation, I guess it's still chapter one, right? Sorry. The comments were great. I think we'll incorporate or revise according to all of the comments from everybody. But one that I did want to check on was the rule of lenity one, which is a from USAO, a recommendation to change the statutory language. So let me pull that up just to the memo. Sorry. Yes. Place. Here we go. So this is would be a change to current 22A-102. I've got pulled it up on the screen. Currently it says, if two or more reasonable interpretations of a statutory provision remain after examination of that provision's plain meaning, structure, purpose, and history, then the interpretation that is most favorable to the defendant applies. And the suggestion is to delete, as kind of marked up there with the strike through, the two or more reasonable interpretations and substitute the meaning, and then to add in the words genuinely in doubt. And, you know, look, I was kind of lead on some of this stuff, and I could say, like, you know, having gone perused some of the case law, like, look, this the one that we had put out there is straight from case law. The change that USAO mentioned is now is also repeatedly mentioned in case law, right? On all this kind of rule of lenity and interpretation provisions, our goal was not to change current law, right? To accurately reflect it. But like I said, arguably the USAO way of doing this, you know, there's case law that adds that in. So just wanted to kind of see what others thought of this language.
We like the staff language, and you know, found a number of cases supporting that as.
So the way it usually comes up in the case law, it'll state it the way that we had in the staff version, which is, and this is, you know, whatever, U.S. Parole Commission v. Noble, Pilate, you know, some recent stuff. And it's often, it's kind of like a 1-2 thing. Like, they'll state the rule as kind of what we initially had for the staff rule, you know, verbatim. And then there'll be this other quotation, I don't know where it eventually derives from. We actually quoted it in the commentary, too, which says the rule of lenity, therefore, can, quote, tip the balance in favor of criminal defendants only where exclusive of the rule, referencing the rule of lenity, a penal statute's language, structure, purpose, and legislative history leave its meaning genuinely in doubt. So, you know, the way the courts seem to constantly bring this up is like, yeah, here's the rule, and again, they want to put on this extra point about, but in the way they are often articulate is, you know, we're not trying to create conflict between statutes that isn't there, or, you know, and so it's this kind of emphasis that, like, yeah, you get to the end of this road, is it genuinely in doubt? Or not. And so, yeah, I hear PDS saying, don't like the change. I'll look at this again and kind of see too, if there's a way to kind of like address the USAO recommendation in another way, like in other words, like, you know, to somehow like state the rule again, kind of as we had it earlier, pulling from the case law, and then see if there's some other way to kind of get at the gist of this, like, is the meaning genuinely in doubt when you get to this?
But also, what we, and now I don't remember where this sentence actually goes because it's been pulled out.
Yeah.
Not to say you have to pull it up right in this
way. Yeah.
But this is after you've gone to legislative history.
That's right. That's right.
Not everything else.
That's right.
But the context becomes important then, because before you get to legislative history, if it's not explicit in rule of lenity, it almost sounds like if we're arguing over what the city council meant, lenity kicks in.
That's right. So yeah, here's
which is sort of like why I thought USAO's actually is closer to when it's used, mm-hmm. as opposed to the way that staff's recommendation was
right. It's not helpful. Yeah. as it's currently articulated.
Okay. Gotcha. So what you would say is it's, well, help me out in understanding a little bit more what's misleading or helpful about it.
If you look at the DCA cases, it's like the current trend is toward what we proposed here and is what, in fact, I think most practitioners on either side actually find helpful on the subject.
Right, and I guess like what it struck me is that it is more the USAO version, you know, and the supporting DCCA case law. What do I want to say? Vernacular is the wrong word, but you know, it is more. You know, is the meaning genuinely in doubt? It's more of a.
It's not debatable.
Yeah. Well, is it genuinely in doubt? And yeah. So again, I.
So I checked with our appellate folks because I sort of said, well, you know, I had sort of a gut instinct, but and I actually wanted to tweak a few things about how it was written. But in any case, so somebody sort of wrote this language, which is from Whitfield, the United States, which is a 2014 DCCA case, 99A3rd. 650. And the line was this: we apply the rule of lenity in a situation like this where the language of the regulation is ambiguous and two alternative interpretations are equally possible. What struck me, like, I was like, oh yeah, that's what that's saying. That's the staff proposal. That I feel like you can gloss over with the way it's written, which I can understand. Perhaps the U.S. Attorney's Office wanting to talk about genuine doubt. I sort of feel like that implies a kind of sincerity to it, as opposed to, it's really, there's more than one interpretation that's reasonable.
Yeah, that's like...
And that somehow the two are more reasonable after, somehow the reasonable part got, for me, I glossed over it as being, it's not that there's more than one interpretation. It's like more than one reasonable one, possible one.
Right, or substantial. The, like you not, want something more than a technical
like
minimal
thing.
Right. And once I think that's and I think that's why the courts keep putting that in, is it's a genuine, it's a real
right.
You know, it has some weight to it.
So
but
does that
how,
bring us closer if we you know, switch no, well
I don't know I don't, like again, I haven't seen, you know, the only I will poke around some more and see if there's other like, you know, language, because again, really just don't want to be adding in any new permutations on this, but if we can find some support for something that does kind of hit this mark more, that isn't quite as technical sounding as what we have now.
Right. Genuine just makes it sound like sincerity in some way, as opposed to plausibility.
Plausibility, weightiness. Yeah. Does that kind of get at what you're concerned about too, Renata? Is that you want to make sure that when it says reasonable interpretations, it's not any two, you know, like, there needs to be some threshold for those possible interpretations, that they need to be serious, you know, plausible, substantial. Is that kind of the concern that you're getting at, that you want to qualify?
I think we were clear.
Okay.
It's our view, and I will re-examine this in light of Whitfield. Which I assume was taken into consideration. But it's our view that that is language that's supported by the actual more recent trend of the court.
Good. All right, well, any other thoughts on this? Anybody else? Otherwise, I'd just say, like, yeah, we'll check on it again and see if there's a way to finesse this in between so it isn't... trying to make everybody happy. I'm trying to make everybody happy. But, you know, maybe we can find language that works. Both of these, again, these are supported by, you know, repeated citations in case law, some recent, some old. So, you know, it's there. All right, well, I mean, we're pretty much at the close. Now, again, as for the other comments on this portion, the rules of interpretation, I thought USAO had, you know, good suggestion for slightly tweaking the statutory language for effective headings and captions to aid the interpretation of, I'll put it on the screen, otherwise ambiguous. I think that is correct, you know, and there's, and I think that's helpful. That's certainly where we intended to go, so I think that's a good clarification.
Where?
I'm putting it on the screen right now, but in 22A110C, on the language on the effect of headings and captions, put in the in all caps the two word change. So again, there is you know, so right. This
okay.
is a bit like
okay.
you know okay. all this interpretation stuff. Like Title 22 is unenacted. Most of the titles that are in there, or titles, captions, headings, whatever you want to choose to call them, a lot of those are from Codification Council. Some of them aren't. Some of them came from Congress when they legislated it. You know. So some of those titles have some real import, right? And so that's why we wanted, and you know, look, arguably titles, to the extent that they are legislatively derived and not just, you know, random attorney codifying things, would be part of the legislative history, right? Or you could even, arguably, in some interpretations, say it's part of the plain meaning of it, because it's going to the text itself that, you know, was selected by the legislature. There's some case law. One thing that you know, USAO had put in its comments refers to a case, and we'll add that to the commentary. But I think the gist of it is that it is again kind of a secondary thing, right? Headings and captions. And this just emphasizes that more when it's otherwise ambiguous. So thought that was great. And again, like everybody else's comments, useful too. And I might follow up like Dave with one comment from OAG about clarifying on the civil liability. And
yeah,
I think
a
it's
case run.
Yeah, I think our intent was to go. I don't think we have a difference on kind of policy or intent, but in terms of drafting, how to redraft the commentary to address that,
okay.
I might follow up with you. But we'll just bring these up again in the next draft. If there's any other thoughts,
just
yeah.
On this,
yeah, yeah.
If we didn't introduce, I was wondering if I had introduced this issue the way I left out the S and exists in our other comment. But I don't think you need we need a comma after the word title. Subsections of this title may aid. You don't need a comma.
Yeah.
That was in
no,
the
that's
original,
right.
but
that's a good
it's
point.
Just, something you can correct.
Good point. Yep, and all those little catches are helpful, so thank you. Yep. Good. Anything else to address as the group? Again, we're happy to kind of follow up individually. Again, we'll get another, there'll be another round of this material, but I don't know that there's... yeah.
So next time we're going to pick up where we left off with 285?
Probably that's right for the next meeting. I'll put together the agenda. We'll definitely, like, those that are still out, these latest ones, the comments won't be due again until after this next meeting.
June 16th.
There we go. Yep. Yes, happy to address that material as well. And again, if anybody wants to meet or discuss anything, just give us a call. Thank you. Chanel, thank you.
No problem.
All right. Take care.
All right. You guys have a good afternoon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Are we off the record?
We are.